Hello, and thank you for listening to the new series, Series 2 of the Nurse Researcher Podcast. This series aims to chat to clinical academics and to really identify what their role entails, how the jobs are split, what they do in their daily life, and really what are the tips and what advice can they give to people aspiring to be a clinical academic. So give us a listen, share the podcast with others, press follow wherever you listen to or get your podcasts, and we hope you enjoy the episodes. Hello and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, and we're here with Series 2 of the podcast, which is our clinical academic series, and I'm delighted today to welcome Leanne Atkin from the Mid Yorkshire NHS Teaching Trust, if I've got that right. Leanne, is that right?
It is. Hello.
And welcome to the episode.
Thank you so much for the invite. I can't wait for our conversation.
I'm sure. And delighted to. It's always good when you can speak to somebody that's listened to the previous series and understands how this works. So it's all about you, Leanne. And sometimes that's the easiest person in the world to talk about, I think. And it's about your story. And Series 2 is about the clinical academic role. I wouldn't say it's ill-defined as, you know, a role of a clinical academic, but we can probably badge it in lots of different ways. So we're going to come on to that with you. And I'm hoping that the listener gets a lot from this episode and understands your role and how they might adapt or learn things from what you do. But we always start, as you'll know, with tell us a little bit how you became a nurse.
So for as long as I remember, I wanted to be a nurse. I have pictures running around with my medical kit and my little nurse's apron on from when I was a very, very young age. But actually, the reason why I became a nurse was cemented when I was 11 years old. I got an E. coli infection and ended up with hemolytic uremic syndrome. And I ended up spending nearly a month on the children's unit at a major hospital in our region. And I loved it. And I know that's really strange to say because I was on border of needing dialysis and all of that, but I loved it. I loved the environment. I loved the nurses that I met. I saw their passion for their job. I saw their happiness in their job, and that it just seemed a joy, if you like. And I also remember, even when I was 11, knowing the impact of that person walking in my room and how that made me feel. And that cemented that that's what I want to do when I grow up. And therefore, I chose my options for my GCSEs at a very young age, thinking that I will go into nursing college one day.
Yeah. And I know so many nurses have got that little picture of them on Christmas Day in the nursing uniform. I don't know any male nurses that have got that picture of them as a little boy. I was dressed up as Superman or in my football strip. But
there was many other costumes in my life, Andrew. I don't think there were just a nurse's one. There were many others that were worn in bad times.
So it sounds like originally a vocation which you've been able to create a profession of. So what was your such early roles in nursing? Where did you start?
So I think that the one thing, though, that the is important for the listeners is that the academic journey can be one that's a little bit convoluted, if you like. So in my day, and I sound like a dinosaur when I say that, I am only 48, you started nursing school at 17 and a half. That's the youngest that you could do. And that's what I wanted to do. But obviously you left school at 16. So you had to do something in between the 18 months. And because I did so well with my GCSEs, I went to college and I wanted to do a pre-nursing course. It was an 18-month course to get me in. And I was told by the principal I was too clever to be a nurse. And actually, he said, you can't do a pre-nursing course. You have to do 4 A-levels. And mum and dad were there at the time, so I ended up doing 4 A-levels. Well, I didn't, because I started college in September. By December, I'd walked out of college and I never went back again. And my principal at the time said to me when I was leaving, I said to him, I want to be a nurse and I can't see the point of doing these 4 A-levels. And he said to me, you'll regret this decision and you'll regret this decision for the rest of your life. I'd love to go back to that principal and just say, I now have a PhD. There's multiple ways. Just, you know, I think it's so young to make lifelong decisions when you are 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. You know, I look at my children, I think, gosh, they don't even know what they want for breakfast, never mind what they want to do for the rest of their life. So I suppose one of my things to everybody that I talk to is it doesn't have to be a linear road. You know, you can make your way through this. So I started nursing college at 17 and a half, and I did the traditional nursing route, if you like, where we had a school on site, and we had placements, and I qualified 3 years after. I spent 2 years as a band five nurse at the time on orthopedics, and then another 18 months on a general surgical ward where I fell in love with vascular medicine. From then, I went to be a ward sister, and then from then, I went to be a nurse specialist. And it's when I was in the nurse specialist role, I got exposed to research. And when many nurses think of research, we think of medical research, we think of decisions of treatment, of effectiveness. But what I were interested in is what makes a good nurse? What's the value of nursing? Why do we need nurses? And my interest has always been in really looking at how is a nurse part of the safety critical workforce, if you like, and how can we strengthen our own research of our effectiveness of what we do? And that's, you know, the inquisitive mind, the questions of why do we do that? And where's the evidence behind that led me into the world of research. But I suppose why I ended up being a clinical academic is often won through fate rather than through design. So I simply were asked to do some lecturing at the local university with this amazing lady at the time who was a reader in nursing called Karen Ouse. And I met this nurse, and Karen is the most broadest Lancaster person you've ever met in your life. She comes across when you speak to her as a bit dumb in a way. But she was absolutely amazing. And when you meet her, you weren't threatened by her. And then she turned into the professor, if you like. And that demystification of not thinking that professors have to be this type of person, that, you know, it is available to any nurse with that aspiration if you have the ability to get there. It's not defined as the well-spoken from the large organizations. And that really helped to demystify what clinical academics could be. So I started just lecturing with Karen for 2 days a week. And then from that, I had the opportunity to undertake my PhD, completed my PhD, and it's that really where the clinical academic role started to formulate. Because I was really conscious that I haven't spent 4 years of my life learning how to be an effective researcher to forget that. So I wanted to, within the organisation, make sure I was able to carry on being a researcher, but also being a clinician.
Okay, I'm going to take you back a bit because we've skipped ahead. There's far more to find out about you yet. It's really interesting, isn't it? It's to sort of think of that almost cross-cutting role of doing the lecturing that fits in with your clinical practice to bring you into this role and this title of clinical academic. And also to go back and apologize, I started the last series by start. I started by calling everybody professor at the beginning. I should have called you Dr. Leanne Atkin, and I'll do that with everybody now who's got a PhD.
Yeah, but at the same time, I am Leanne and I'm the leg nurse. I'm quite proud to be called a nurse. I also think that we have to acknowledge, Andrew, if you've been on Twitter recently, there is a huge debate that's happening in between of the protectivism, if you see, I think, of from a medical perspective. There is no way that I would use my doctor title in front of any of my patients because I want them to know I'm a nurse. And you know, I don't think anybody should be in a position to in allowing us to say call ourselves something outside of work when you've earned it through an assured route. But it still makes me slightly cringe a little bit that I'd rather be called Leanne.
Yeah, but I mean I agree, and I think a lot of this has come around the physician's associate role as well, hasn't it?
It
And
has.
I think we have to recognize that it's a solid and title to be proud of in academia, and one that enhances the medical and nursing aspect of our role. But I always say, if we were struck off, Leanne, we wouldn't lose our doctor title. If it's a
Indeed.
medical title, you would lose the doctor title because because the qualification we have is the doctorate, isn't it? Rather than the
Indeed.
medical degree. So I'm very proud of the title, but like you, I wouldn't want it on a badge in clinical practice.
No. There's so many things that when you look back at the history, the doctor title actually came from academia, then the medics pinched it, you could argue. And actually, when a medic retires and gives up his GMC registration, they have no legal stance to continue to call themselves a doctor. And I find all of that interesting. I think that as I keep trying to point out to people when they talk about the physician associate role, nurses are very different. We're sat on a very solid legal framework of professionalism and regulation in our own entity. And therefore, us as nurses will decide what we as nurses will do. And we do not need doctors' permission to be able to do one thing or another. And I think that the more we distance ourselves from other professional roles, I think the better for nursing. But it's an interesting remit. And what I'd say is Twitter's becoming more and more toxic on a weekly
Yeah,
basis.
there's a crossover, isn't there, of getting your autonomy for your discipline, but equally recognizing the value of the interdisciplinary working across the different disciplines. I want to take you back to your academic qualifications. So, did you do a diploma at first, or did you start with a degree?
As soon as I qualified, I liked education. So as soon as I qualified, I just started to pick up university modules. So I did one originally in orthopedics because I was an orthopedic nurse. I did one, believe it or not, in environmental health at the time because I was a bit of a hippie when I was growing up, so I was interested in all of that. Again, and this is what I think is really useful for the audience to know. I don't have a degree. I had 360 points, but I never got awarded a degree from any organization because they came from multiple organizations of multiple across the set. But that allowed me to get onto a master's level qualification, and I did the Advanced Clinical Practice Master's before it was called that, and I completed that in 2010. But you can get onto a master's level qualification with evidence of level three study. You don't need a full degree to get onto a master's, and I think many people don't understand that. So again, education can be hybrid. So yes, I did my master's, and that was awarded in 2010 as completeness. But my diploma and my degree was just an accumulation of academic points rather than an actual award.
And how did you come to do the PhD? So you were working in the trust, you are Leanne the leg lady, and you're working in the trust, you're lecturing, and you've got that vascular medicine speciality. Who tells you to do a PhD, or who supports you to do a PhD? How did that come about?
So, within academia, there is a drive for lecturers to have a PhD. Some universities mandate it. And at the time, when I started my PhD, I didn't know where my career would take me. I was a Band 7 specialist nurse at the time, and I wanted all my doors open to decide, am I going to go full time into academia or not? So I horizon scanned and I thought, you know what, I'm probably going to need this at some point. And I had that inquisitive mind. I also wanted to prove to myself and others that, you know, I can do this. And what many people think a PhD is an assessment of your intelligence. I'm not sure it is. I think it's more of an assessment of your perseverance. And I think that you've got to understand a PhD is also a learning journey. That you are not the same person when you enter your PhD to when you complete your PhD. So it's not something you have to come at that level ready for. I saw this going around, and I had a word with Professor Uzi by then. And I think a PhD often scares people that you'd think, gosh, I'll never be able to do that. But because Karen is so normal and so unthreatening, she was like, of course you can, you know. And that just sent a worm into into the brain. So I at the time I was only lecturing on a secondment for a day a week over to the university. So I brought that information back to my clinical team. I have been extremely privileged that I have been supported by four amazing vascular surgeons, and all of them male, all of them now in their 50s, but all of them so progressive with what a nurse can do, should do, and what I can do as an individual. And what I read on Twitter is completely different to what I experience in-house. I have had their full support since day one. And I took this back thinking that they might say, who do you think you are? And they went, of course you can, girl. Why wouldn't you want to do that if you've got the opportunity? And as much as I got the approval within my clinical fraternity, my organisation did not see the value and they did not want to support in terms of any form of study leave on a regular basis. I think I have to acknowledge that I'm going back now, probably when I started, it was 2013, and I do think that's changing. But to complete my PhD, my organisation at the time gave me 1 hour study leave a week. And if you imagine as a nurse, you're already overworking from about 6 hours for free. Well, where did that go? I never got any time to complete the PhD from in-house. And but I do think that's changed. And I think that within my organisation, we've just appointed somebody to do their PhD on a scholarship. And they're getting 2 days a week for the whole 5 year programme. So I do think that's changed. And I think that's because NHS organisations are realising the value of non-medics holding that level of award.
So the PhD is a success. At what point does somebody say to Leanne, do you want to be a clinical academic? Or did it not happen in that way? How did the title come about? And has that become contractual for you?
And that's, I suppose, is the hardest journey, Andrew, of all of this, is that the role evolved into that, but actually formulating that on paper and on job description has been the highest of battles. And it's not from an executive point of view within the organisation. The executive point of view really understand that we have just been awarded teaching status. We're wanting to go for university status in the next few years, and the board is completely, yeah, we will support this. We, you know, this is where we're going, and we've appointed two or three now clinical academics, professors in, and clinical academics. The issue was within the division, in terms of I work within a specific division of surgery, and it was really difficult for them to see the value of this. Because they see the value of you should be in clinic, you should be seeing patients. We've got an 18-week wait, we've got theatres that need covering. And it was really difficult for them to see the wider value. And it's taken years of constant hen pecking at them, sometimes even with an ice pick, for them to be able to see this. But over the last 3 months, there has been huge change within this. And now that it is within a framework, that it is actually acknowledged within my job description that this is a true jointly funded clinical academic position. And I think what our legacy has to be, Andrew, is we've got to make that easier for the next generation, because I think it's unfair what I've had to go through the years to get the acknowledgement. One of my senior nurses once said to me, but the research you do is only of value to the university. And you know, and if my senior nurse is saying this, I just want to cry. But I do think that's changing. And I think Ruth May has been instrumental at this, of putting out that position of research, of really raising that, you know, if we're going to really move the profession of nursing forward, we need an evidence base to do that. And that evidence base should come from nurses.
Absolutely. So what's I mean, What does your contract look like? And I don't mean on paper, but from a 5-day working week,
So,
what's your role?
I have official university days, Mondays and Thursdays, and then Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and clinical. And that's how it's split. The difficult with that, though, Andrew, is that a research meeting that's going to scope a research bid that's going to come into funding both to the university and into the NHS. What day should that sit on? And it's really hard as a nurse. You try to put things into compartments. This is this role, this is that role. And I hope that that moves forward because a consultant surgeon clinical academic would never be asked, what are you doing today? University work or clinical work? And I think that we more that we murky this pot, that it's not black and white, that one thing feeds into the other thing, that the benefits are mutual. And I think that's why formulating the clinical academic roles will help to do that, because hopefully people will see more than a job plan and they'll see an actual role of what you can do.
And do you find it easy to bleed the roles into one another?
And I find it hard not to bleed the roles into one another.
That
That's my
that
mom.
sounds good. That sounds the right way.
I don't know how you can do one without the other. But I think that's because my research is very clinically based. You know, other clinical academics, their research is lab based or professional based rather than clinically based. And therefore, I can see that you can separate those two things easier. But a lot of my research is clinically grounded research. So, you know, whenever I'm in clinic, I'm scratching my head about what's the next research question. I'm trying to recruit patients into studies. I'm trying to get research through the NHS regulations to be able to get there. I'm constantly scoping out for money and bids of how we can get it awarded. So you know, it's never one or the other. And you know, I'm not saying everything is plain sailing. I still have debates of I've submitted an abstract to a conference and I'm off to present on that conference and I'm asked, well, should that be in your clinical day? And you're like, well, you know, yeah, because there shouldn't be a thing as a clinical day or a non-clinical day. It should be this is your role. There's still challenges. I see certain light at the end of the tunnel that we'll crack this. I think for the next generation, I hope to pave the ground that all of what we're talking about today becomes sorted.
I mean, I was going to say that it does, and I say this a lot in this podcast. It does sound like a lot of the people you speak to have had to trailblaze if they're not currently trailblazing. What have been the main setbacks for you? Has it been that line of demarcation that other people paint between your days, or has there been other challenges that maybe our listeners might have to think about or look towards?
I think I've spoke about some of the challenges. I think first off, I have to acknowledge that I'm a mum, and at times throughout my academic lifetime, I was a single mum, and my kids still said to me at the time, "You're always behind the computer." They still joke to me now that you were always behind and still are behind the computer. And as a mum, there's an element of guilt with that, and you know. That still lives with me today, and you know, I still struggle with that. It's interesting because the boys were upstairs on their Xbox behind their own computer. They weren't interested in spending time sitting with mum. But and I, if you ask them, it didn't bother them, but those words bothered me. I said that, you know, I think the biggest challenge, and I think it's really a shame, has not been the medics, it's been other nurses. And I do think sometimes we are the most kindest profession to our own. We're so kind to everybody we serve, but to our own, we often try to put people down, put people into a box, limit their career progression. And I think Agenda for Change doesn't help that. You know, it's this or this or this, and you move up only when dead man's shoes happen. And when I first got introduced to Agenda for Change, it wasn't supposed to be like that. It was supposed to be you get so much experience and so much knowledge and academic award, you would move up through those bandings. But it's never been like that. And I think that, so I think the biggest challenge really has been other nurses, especially your senior nurse or your line manager. And I still hear that today from a lot of the students that's now taking their pre-doctoral or their doctoral awards. It's their line manager that they're really struggling with and who is a nurse. So I suppose if you are listening to this, the one thing we should do is just to help our own profession, you know, give each other a hand up. And absolutely, Andrew, me and you are stood here as trailblazers, but on the shoulders of other people already. And so, you know, we have to help the people up that ladder and you know, support them on our shoulders if we want the nursing profession to continue to evolve.
I mean, the early stages of my career, early parts of my career, I worked for rheumatologists in a rheumatology unit, and they were really supportive. And I think that the nurses that developed in that area were because of the rheumatologists and the way that they supported. And then later in my career, most of my supporters come from GPs, academic
Yes.
GPs who I've worked with and for. And I agree with you. I think we're too competitive with one another, and I don't know why there is that. I often say we're stronger if we work together than against one another. I hear other people say nurses eat their young,
Absolutely.
which is a terrible saying. And I heard a chief nursing officer, not ours, but a chief nursing officer at a conference say, if I had a nurse turning on a spit, I'd find another nurse to turn it. And you do have to look at that, don't you, and say, come on, let's work together. You know, there's, you know, united, you're much stronger than actually working apart. And I agree. And I hope that podcasts like this are where these line managers can listen to things like this and go, ah, yeah, that's what Leanne does, or that's what person X does. That's what this role's about. Because sometimes the conversations you have on this, you don't have with one another. And you know, and people who've known professors on series one say, I didn't know anything about them until I listened to the podcast. Get to know the person to understand the role, don't you, to some extent.
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the things, if you are starting to think about this role, it's what's your exposure internally. So, you know, for quite some time, I was what they call a key opinion leader. I hate that title, but I was a key opinion leader for the UK. Actually, I was speaking internationally across the whole of Europe, but I was unknown inside my own organization. And that's because that exposure stemmed from the university role, if you like, doing that. And I think that's one thing that I did acknowledge is how do you do that at the same time as ensuring that your exposure internally is also growing at the same level? And I think I shied away from it because I had a difficult line manager who didn't see the value. And sometimes I struggle with people when I think it's so goddamn obvious. Why don't you get it? And I often reflect on a night time between the hours of 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. of how can I communicate that better? How are they not understanding what the value is? And you know, really procrastinating in yourself of ways that you can. But I do think, though, Andrew, I do wonder whether what we speak about is a generation of nurses who's at our age, slightly older than us. And I do speak to a lot of younger nurses at the university, and I do think that they are more supportive of each other. And I really hope that they listen to these podcasts and don't allow them to lose their internal values that they've got already. You know, be that nurse leader in the future that is that true compassionate leadership, you know, and let's get rid of this. And you know, we often nurses continue to evolve. And you know, if you think of the dinosaur nurses that we had, we've got rid of those and we are all now evidence-based practitioners. I hope that the sort of unsupportive leadership is going to retire off the other side, and actually what we're going to be left with is a really inspiring and supportive and compassionate a group of nurses that what we've got there.
And I think it comes down to your own personal sense of your role, doesn't it, as well? It comes down to that. I mean, I think for everybody I probably helped up the ladder in a very junior role, they then reached down and pulled me up afterwards. So I've always wondered whether, you know, the next student who I mentor becomes my boss one day. I'm all conscious of that. You know, I've got PhD students at the minute that are far, far more intelligent than me, you know, and will fly. I know they will. But I know I did my little bit, and they might be able to do me a favor one day in the way that I think I've done them a favor. And equally, you have to
But
always view that, don't you? Treat everybody quite equal. And
but you're of the same ilk that me, that I sit back like a proud mother hen and watch my babies fly. I don't see a threat from that. I see pride from that. And I think other people are threatened by that. I think that I was asked last year what's the most inspiring thing I did. And if you asked me that 5 years ago, I'd probably say direct patient care. I love making somebody feel valued and happy and well cared for and supporting their complex decisions. I love that. But actually, over the last 5 years, I think my greatest pride now comes from inspiring the next generation. Because I look at these 20-year-old, 30-year-old nurse leaders, I know where they're going. They don't know where they're going yet, but I can see that they are destined for high things. And I love, as you said, to be part of their Lego brick of their future, of I'll help you in your foundations. I will help you inspire in, to be, the best you possibly can be. I think that gone are the days where nursing is only a option of clinical or managerial and you're 100% one or 100% the other. I never wanted to be a nurse manager. I never wanted to lose contact with my patients. And I think the clinical academic role is something that's able for you to keep in patient focused in front of that patient, but also shape the nursing in the widest of form, deliver that education to the next generation and formulate the knowledge of nursing going forward. And I think that's why the clinical academic role actually is something that we really need to celebrate because it keeps nurses on the shop floor, but at the same time pushing the agenda of nursing.
Absolutely. I think you've nailed it there. A daft question probably now after everything we've heard you said or heard you say, but if there's an AHP listening or a midwife listening or a nurse from the community or primary care, are you promoting this role for people? Is this something that you promote and say, yeah, clinical academic roles?
100%. 100%. And that's because of the variety of the workload. And I think we all have to acknowledge that actually clinical work is really challenging. And it's really challenging, not for the job you do, but the pressures of the organization that you sit in. And I have to acknowledge that I don't know whether I'd be such a happy nurse if I was full-time clinical, because I don't know how the clinical nurses cope with that day on, week on, week on. And I think that one of the things that a clinical academic role gives you is a bit of a break from that to see a horizon of a better world rather than just become entrenched within that. And that's not because of the individual's issues at all. It's the organization that or the pressures that they're working in. So I think the clinical academic world helps you to still be a nurse, but do other things, so therefore you are not a full-time clinical nurse. And I take my hats off to anybody that's doing that job and loving that job. And I have to also acknowledge that, I am nearly 50, and some of that might come from it. When I was in my 20s, I loved being a clinical nurse. I did all extra shifts and I had more enthusiasm. I just think today's NHS is a difficult thing. So I think the clinical academic role allows you to keep very passionate clinically, but also explore everything else and breaks your week up in the nicest of sense. So you can not get so entrenched in one or the other. I'm not saying academia is easy. If you think there's red tape in the NHS, you should see the red tape in the university. I've had more knocks from a university point of view in terms of if your bid's been rejected again. You have to get a different type of resilience in that world. It is so rewarding. And personally and also, clinically and academically.
And so much of what you've said, I've been making notes, has resonated with me and my career to some extent. And I think hopefully this resonates with people either, on the pathway to a clinical academic role or currently doing one. So my final question for you would be, so what's Leanne's ambitions going forward now? What do you hope to achieve? What do you want to do with the rest of your career? Because the pension situation, Leanne, we aren't going quickly, are we? So if you've got,
So,
let's say you've got 20 years left to work, and you may well have,
yeah, thanks for that, Andrew.
what are the ambitions?
So it's really interesting because when I finished my master's, I went no more. And then I did a PhD. And then when I finished my PhD, I went no more. And since I've done my PhD, I've done two further postgraduate certificates. My journey will include more formal education because I like knowledge. I like learning new things. And if you'd asked me 2 years ago, I'd have said, this is probably it. This is probably best I'll get. But because of the movement of university status educate hospitals, I think that there may well be an opportunity for nursing clinical professors. And I think that that becomes really interesting. And I suppose I'd just leave it with the chief nurse at this moment in time within most NHS organisations does not practice as a nurse. Why is that? If your chief medical officer will still be a practicing consultant, but the nurse comes away from her actual core role. And I just question why is that? Because I think that to keep true, then I think it's much better if you were able to still practice out there on the front of the coal face. So I hope that clinical professors in nursing starts to change that you can still actually go out there and do a shift, but you can practice at this higher level at the same time as that. So you never know, Andrew. One day I might be that common speaking professor that actually inspires the next generation, just like Professor Karanoosi did for me.
Marvelous. So we'll welcome you at some point onto the to a later professor series. That will be the ambition,
Very good indeed.
Leanne.
Well, I'm sure we'll be still kicking around by then, Andrew.
Well, it's been wonderful to speak to you, and I'm sure this will be a great episode for the listeners. So, Leanne Atkins, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been my pleasure.
Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And joining me again, as always, is Eleanor Hovard. And Eleanor, we are talking today about Leanne Atkins. Tell us a little bit about what you thought about Leanne.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Another great interview. This is really interesting listening to Leanne's story, and she gave a very honest, open story, I thought, about her journey as a clinical academic. And I thought what she really described really well was that the road isn't linear on the clinical academic pathway. It doesn't have to be, and usually it isn't, is it? And also she spoke a bit about the work that needs to be done, perhaps around dismantling stereotypes around what professors are like. And I suppose that's what part of the aim was as well in the first series, wasn't it? It was to understand, what professors do, how people got there. And there's a really diverse range of individuals that are in those professorships. And then the other thing that came through really strongly for me was the concept of value. And she mentions this several times about others seeing the value in being a clinical academic and in the work that that clinical academics do. And she did say that she did feel that things were improving. But I think it is tricky, isn't it? Because there is a lack of understanding, I think, of around what clinical academics are. It's a bit mysterious, and perhaps more so in nursing. And because these roles tend to be quite bespoke, everybody's probably looks journey probably does look very different. And then also just on the back of that, she did explain how the role it doesn't really separate into distinct days, does it? When you have a contract, you might have 2 days clinical, 3 days academic, or whatever. But actually, those roles always generally overlap, and it's quite difficult to just focus on one aspect. Most of the time. And then also, I think it was really valuable what she said about identifying who your supporters are, and that doesn't just have to be nurses, does it? She spoke about the vascular surgeons that were really supportive of her career too. I think that's a really important point to work alongside our multi-professional teams that we do have and support each other. And then the other thing that she'd mentioned was quite interesting was about the exposure that she'd had. And she had developed her visibility nationally and internationally, but in her own organization, her exposure wasn't so great. And perhaps that's just depends on the organization and other people, and maybe that valuing of the clinical academic role. So a really interesting interview, I thought, and some really important points that she raised.
Yeah, I like Leanne. She's a northerner and I'm a Midlander, so we come with accent, take it or leave it. But very straight talking, very to the point, and very passionate about the things she discussed. I think You can clearly see the passion for what she does clinically and the role she had. And although she talked about, moving her career away from, full-time clinical practice, there was a reason for that, wasn't there? It's because she could do things more strategically, and she'd got that academic element to the role. Like you, I think I heard how she valued the sort of platform she was given by the vascular surgeons. And I think what happens is that you become part of a cohort of a health profession. So when as you get older in your profession, so do the medics that you worked with who were junior, and as you become more senior, so do they. And you can open doors for one another, can't you? You're probably not going to get a very senior surgeon taking under their wing somebody who's just qualified. But if you've trodden the boards with them a little bit and you've worked with them, then I've seen that happen as well. I've seen that happen in my own background of rheumatology, where you sort of grow up with the medics as they grow up in their roles, you grow up in yours, and they're very enabling. If you've worked with people and you've earned the respect of them in your own clinical field, then they're very enabling academically as well, and they can open doors, and you can help one another. And I it made me think of my own career a little bit when she talked about that. I think with Leanne, I think she's probably, if I talk about cohorts, and you and I are probably similar age to Leanne, then we're probably going to be the people that tread the ground for the next group, the next cohort of nurses, the generation behind us, that normalize clinical academia, that normalize the role of it. Leanne's having to sort of tread new ground. She's having to battle here and there a little bit about compartmentalizing her job. Trying to put it into, I think she described it as a job plan, and that's not possible. It's more of a role. Maybe we'll be looking back in 10 years' time and thinking, God, I can't believe it was that difficult. And I think series one was about demystifying the professor role. What is it? How did they get there? And this has become a little bit not how did they get there with the clinical academic, more what does it mean? What do you do? That seems to be what it's become.
I think so. And I think it does make you wonder, though, as well, how much the role is going to continue to evolve too. I'm sure maybe in the future, maybe it will be called something else. But I guess as long as the aim is still the same, the purpose of being able to d develop your own research is to benefit patients. And I suppose in some professions, it's been more developed than in others, hasn't it? But I think, it was really interesting how Leanne described her journey and quite unique. I think what resonated with me, something else she said though, was about when you were talking about the challenges of being a clinical academic, but also she spoke about some of the personal challenges, about being a mom as well, and how your kids always, her kids saw her behind the computer, and the guilt that you get, I think, sometimes when you are focusing on academic work as well. I know I've felt that too. Sometimes my kids have pointed out to me, "Mom, you're still working," and it's like, oh, well, you need to do it, and you're passionate about it, but then you do feel guilty, don't you? But I think it's difficult. That's probably one of the things you have to learn, isn't it? It's always about getting that balance right, and there are some times when you have to, that balance isn't great. But yeah, I thought
I
really,
mean,
really interesting to hear from her.
I would describe her as resilient, and it's a term I think isn't always used in the right ways in nursing. I think I fear over the last few years it's been, can you do more for less with limited resources? And if not, you're not resilient. And I hate that sort of the value given to resilience in that way. But there's a sense that with her that, she talked about being a single parent. She talked about almost difficulty sometimes demonstrating what value she offered beyond her own institution, trying to carve out the role, but equally recognizing that when other people are getting it, not so much easier than now, but they're getting it a bit more structured. She said somebody'd now got 2 days supported to do what she did without really any protected time. She doesn't begrudge them that. She's glad that that's what's happening now. And I think that's where we are, aren't we? Our sort of cohort, our generation now needs to think that if it's getting a little bit easier to be an academic or a clinical academic, that's a good thing. That's not something to say, oh, you've had it easy, because that's how we should have had it. So I liked the fact that she valued the fact that that it's not getting easier, but it's getting more structured and more accepted and more supported, I think, is probably what I'm trying to get at.
And I think an appreciation for the fact that actually to do the job well and to be able to undertake your research, you do need that protected time. One day a week. I don't know how she did that in one day a week,
No.
You know, doing a PhD one day a week, even over 5 years, must have been incredibly difficult. Even 2 days is going to be hard, isn't it? You know,
Yeah.
because there is so much work to do. But I think you're right. I think that appreciation for it is becoming more apparent.
And you know, I dare say you sit here talking to me on screen as a mum in situ with a PhD, so it resonates with you as well, you know, that it is a battle, isn't it, to try and keep everybody happy, you know, when you're trying to do different aspects of a role and work, and there's family and social life, isn't there, that is competing, understandably.
It does, and I think doing your PhD does often feel like a selfish endeavor, but you know, I think you probably I do feel that I'm getting better at that work-life balance. I think it takes a while, and you're kind of always working with this bit of guilt. If you're not working on your PhD, you feel guilty, and then if you are working on it, you feel guilty for not doing other things. But I think that's just something that you get used to, and I suppose it really is important to find that balance. But that's just practice, I think, and experience, isn't it?
I have to be honest with you. When I was doing my PhD, when I started, we had a 2-year-old and a newborn baby when I started my PhD. So I was writing my acknowledgement page of my thesis in my mind for 3 years, and always sort of thinking, God, it's a good job my wife's really supportive. It's a good job that really, because I and the final year of my PhD, I worked Sunday as well, and I came into the university and I needed it in the final year really just to get over the line. And I constantly felt guilty about doing that, but I was constantly writing the acknowledgement page in my head. And I think one line I can remember from the acknowledgement page of my thesis is, I did it for you and I couldn't have done it without you.
Yeah.
And that's, I couldn't have had a better phrase than that, really. You know, when you're thanking your family, because you do need their support and you do need their understanding.
You do, and it's really difficult sometimes to explain, isn't it? But you know, you have to devote yourself, don't you? If you want to be able to do your PhD, you do have to devote yourself to it. But at the same time, your family and your supporters, whoever it is that are surrounding you, is really important as well to spend time with them too, isn't it? So it is that striking that balance that is a challenge. It's one of the other challenges, I think, isn't it?
I know, and hopefully they bear the fruits of your labour, don't they? That's
exactly.
You know, I think when I went for my graduation was probably 18 months after my PhD. So by then I'd probably got a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old or something like that. So to sort of go and stand by the vice chancellor with your floppy hat and your gown and to wave to them sitting down, I could see how proud they were. So you sort of think, you know, that almost ended that chapter. It was nice.
Yeah.
And I would say that to anybody, that really, you know, the fruits of your labor, if you develop your career and you progress, then that's a wonderful thing for your family to see. And you must always credit them for it. And I think Leanne would be somebody that said, you know, the kids have been understanding and they probably, I haven't asked her this, but I imagine they stood there at her graduation as proud as punch, you know, when
I'm
mum
sure.
became doctor.
I think, you know, your family or friends, whoever it is that's around you, they kind of come along on the journey with you in some ways, don't they? Whether it's their choice or not, but they do in some ways.
Well,
and
we
I
mention your PhD from
for.
time to time in these summaries, so we are perhaps on the listener is perhaps on your journey with you as well.
Yes,
So,
yeah.
They might need a few hundred tickets to your graduation
Next year, hopefully, yeah, next year.
So we thank Leanne, and thanks for your time again today, Eleanor. I think that probably wraps it up with
Thank
that
you,
episode,
Andrew.
And I'll catch up with you for the next one.
Take care.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.